Local Code podcast is hosted by Ramesh Gudnawadna, architectural educator, and Renee Vamuen at the University of Western Australia. We're both directors of the company Felix Laboratories. The Local Code podcast has been brought to you by Sologain. Sologain has been in operation for over 20 years now. When you're looking for solar, go with someone who stands that test of time. Call today on 1300 739355 or simply go to their website, solargain.com.au.
All right, so welcome to Local Code. I'm Ramesh and we're here with Renee, as usual. And today we're joined by Grant Revell, Professor Grant Revell, as I've seen on the internet, Grant, who's a landscape architect who's been working extensively in the Indigenous landscape space for all of his career, not only with Australian Aboriginal landscapes, but also in communities in Bali. He has expertise in a number of areas of landscape. And Grant, perhaps I could ask you first, what does it mean to be a landscape architect working in Indigenous landscape?
Thanks, Ramesh, and thanks for the invite. I did want to begin with an acknowledgement of country and Whadjuk Noongar elders, past, present, and emerging. And I think in our discussion today, we'll get to the bottom of knowing that, you know, without country, we really are, nothing. And I think that's an important premise to understanding landscape. I was drawn to the Indigenous space. I mean, it's a long story, and it happened when I was really young, living in Adelaide Hills and living with Aboriginal communities. So I understood, the importance of multiple worldviews, and particularly place worlds and their differences. So getting an interest in landscape architecture came from that kind of knowing and existence as a young kid.
Yeah, so I should just affirm that you're actually a non-Indigenous person who found their way to landscape through Indigenous encounters. I've just read the article that you've written in Curve magazine, which came out last year, but was written earlier. It's an influential magazine in intellectual landscape pursuits, not unlike Transition, which was the architecture version of Curb. It was organised and centred around RMIT in Melbourne. Unlike Transition, it's survived, thankfully, and it still offers a voice for landscape practitioners and academics, right? How do you reflect on the influence the Curb is still having on the plight of landscape activism and disruption in your world?
Yeah, really interesting question. I think to acknowledge the origins of Curb, it came at a time when in the early mid-80s, there was some pretty strong student activism in Melbourne in particular. And it came about with relationships between RMIT, Melbourne University School of Design, and other important peripheries like the Burnley Horticultural College and other agencies. But there was a groundswell, and it was student-led, and most importantly, it was student-led, and it was quite deep because it combined undergraduate and postgraduate thinking. And in those days, you know, PhDs in landscape and in architecture was a new thing. And we had that scholarship at the table, and often there were fantastic gatherings. And most importantly, there was the birth of the EDGE student conference series. And I was fortunate to be a foot soldier on the first one that came out of Melbourne. And, you know, the likes of Kevin Taylor was a key player there, Jerry DeGrice, Maggie Fook, and some great sessional teachers that were activists in their own right. Now, they worked with students at the time, and we that first EDGE conference was phenomenal. I actually didn't quite understand the depth of landscape and scholarship until we had all the, you know, the presenters run with this phenomenal conference over a number of days. From that EDGE series, CURB was born. And, you know, we're fortunate to host one of the EDGE conferences here in UWA in Western Australia.
When was that?
That was around about 1995. So, you know, CURB was formed in 94. And the controversial setting for our EDGE conference here, which was called WEDGE, was on Wadjimup, Rottnest Island. And as a team here, the teachers and students decided to go to Wadjimup because it was, and still remains, a contested landscape. And so it was ripe for a lot of deep discussions and quite a phenomenal national student conference over there on the island.
So how has CURB managed to remain active and relevant over this time?
Mm. It's an interesting, you know, CURB, I think, probably wants to speak for itself in some ways, but I always was impressed with the leadership by the likes of Julian Ruxworthy, Eamon Fennessy, and others who underline the importance of it being student-led. So each issue has a different editorial and student group, and I think now it might even get, you might even get academic credit to be a part of that CURB editorial team, which is kind of interesting, you know, that that level of scholarship and publication can be brought to formal university studies. But RMIT, and at the time we were running the program here at UWA, RMIT was always known for its intellectual landscape rigor. It was rambunctious, it was disruptive, and it would contest some pretty important arguments in Australia. And I think a lot of students just fell in love with that discourse.
Do you think it's fair to say that Indigenous knowledge conceptions are fundamental to the way that landscape architecture runs in Australia? Or is there a, is there still a contest between a traditional Western-centric notion of landscape and a broader understanding of what landscape is?
Well, I think there's undeniably all roads lead to the Indigenous Centre in Australian environmental studies, cultural studies. I mean, I think even in the growth of our time since being, you know, academics in Perth, Western Australia's contributed enormously to this debate and understanding of what constitutes worldviews in the first place. How do we understand Earth and its performance? And then who are the custodians in these responsibilities? And we now appreciate that the stories of Australia are deep and very, very old. So if we don't enter into those libraries of knowledge, then I think we're fooling ourselves.
So is there, you know, talking about it's new, was it CURB that was new, or was the landscape profession in the field of academic landscape studies new?
Good question. I think it was running tandem. I mean, I think even in my formal landscape architectural studies at Melbourne Uni, it was driven by the likes of George Seddon, Michael McCarthy and others, who Jan Schapper, who really had a very strong visual landscape bent.
Marion Blackwell.
Yeah, Marion from here. And the understanding of sensing environment was predominantly visually driven. And I knew from my previous work as a planner and in land management that that was absolutely folly, that we needed to understand these deeper stories in how we sensed environment into landscape.
So was that coming from a picturesque tradition from a Western centre, like
very much
England and yeah. France.
Yeah, George Seddon was running the Centre for Environmental Studies at Melbourne Uni, where landscape architecture was located, and they were running up and down the landscapes of Victoria doing visual assessment studies. George's famous, you know, power corridor, road easement, transport corridor assessments were visually driven. And we all knew as students, and we did poke the bear there, and George would come into our crits, and we said, look, George, you're only getting a little bit of the story here. How about we go and ask the community about how they're reading landscapes? And it's not just visually, but there's some deeper stories here and sensory elements of what turns environment into landscape.
Wasn't there always an ecological consciousness in landscape architecture?
Yeah.
I'm surprised when I saw a stub somewhere about the origins of Oxford and Cambridge universities, yeah. that their first, among their first faculties was a faculty of forestry.
Yeah.
I know that comes from a royal estate management mindset, but it implies that an ecological framework was implicit even in the later emergence of the picturesque.
Yeah.
Is that when did the ecological systems become part of the study of landscape architecture?
Yeah. Well, I think the subjects of the ecological design were first picked up by, you know, Ian McCarg. And scholars of that ilk and of that time.
At UPenn.
Yeah. And McCarg is, you know, famous for his overlay methodologies of, you know, laying out all the ologies of the environment and trying to understand their relationships, you know, overlay after overlay. And that was pretty important. I mean, I remember as a student at Melbourne Uni, we used to do those overlays manually. We would have, you know, film and vellum on the light table, you know, 2 inches thick.
Yeah.
And we're looking at the relationships between one ecology and the other in those overlays. But I think to then take that those data sets and turn them into design processes, that was the big move. And so we have the growth of, you know, biophilic design processes where people were mimicking nature and cultural responses to that. But I think we're also looking at rebuilding systems to support ecological health. And that was, as we began to be taught, and I think this is where Curve had a great responsibility, we started to understand that designers had a big role to play in that. It was spatial knowledge, and it was a manipulative process that could be regenerative for greater community appreciation and stewardship, of course.
So the graphical elements of this, the mapping and the representation, those become investigative and communication tools for landscape.
Yeah.
Is there still a place for a picturesque mindset? Is that still an important part?
Well, I think so. I think it's, you know, of course, it's in a well-embedded value on landscape, and, you know, you only have to look at the real estate industry to see how important the visual aspects of where we live,
yeah.
and how, you know, external environments are supposed to perform in the home setting. But I think people are understanding that that's only just part of an environmental experience. It's pretty easy. I mean, I spent a long number of years in jobs, for example, in land management, where we mapped forests for their scenic values. And the great disappointment and legacy of that, especially in the West Australian Southwest landscapes, is we didn't come clean with the need to be productive in the way we were to grow and manage trees, for example. So forests pretended to be national parks. They pretended to provide multiple values when I think we should have said, look, you know, these forests are producing timber, these forests are for national parks. It's a bit like growing potatoes on the edge of the Southwest Highway. You know, you don't necessarily do it for scenic reasons, but I think there was a confusion in understanding landscape at that time. And we're talking, you know, we're talking late 80s here, early 90s, and I was heavily involved in the management planning of the Southwest Forest.
Yeah, so if, that's around the time of all of the wood chip bomber.
Exactly. Yeah, this is
Dunchester.
Yeah, this is where I was fronting up at the North Cliff Hotel to help run a community meeting about, you know, saving Melaleuca wetlands.
Yeah. Now, in the article, Grant, you talk about, you refer to Jerry Gill's work.
Mm.
And can you just give us a brief outline of Jerry Gill's discussions of the context of the landscape profession at the time the article was written, and about your own changes at that time?
Mm.
I mean, what was the mood and how did the students react?
Yeah. I think one of the great lines in the article by Gill, as a sociologist, and you know, this is the fantastic abilities of CURB, is to go down those other corridors and attract other academics to the discussion about landscape. Now, Gill was a sociologist. He says in his article that, you know, Indigenous people were not just considered great ecologists because they looked after nature. He says that they were able to reconcile the differences between their worldviews and their environmental views. Now, for me at the time, I thought that was quite revelatory, you know, to then talk to students and say, what are your worldviews and what's your understanding of environment? And how do you have a debate within yourself and within your own client groups about those differences? And of course, that's where the Indigenous worldview had to be put on the table. Now, we then learned how to collaborate on those understanding of those worldviews. We were interested in the Indigenous voice to be able to represent those worldviews. And I think students appreciated that. So Gill, I think he then understood that often the relationships between worldviews and environments was expressed in terms of strife. And that's another important point in his article, that these relationships are always about strife. And he means that it's a productive relationship. I mean, strife can be negative, it can be full of trauma and troublesome, but it is a relationship that we're interested in here. And I think that opened up a whole new thinking for landscape architecture.
Strife in the sense of crisis and collapse leading to a reinvention of some of disciplines and economies and politics.
And so we get this understanding that, you know, where is the barometer in the landscape that indicates strife? And that gave, I think, students new skills to go out and say, how do I find the barometer? Who's representing the barometer? So that opens up a whole set of questions about community-driven design. You know, who can speak for landscape, who can speak for environment and worldviews? Where is the strife? How is it expressed? Who's managing it? And how can we bring design to that process?
So which particular strife or emergency was the context of Gill's commentary at that time?
Well, I think Gill he unashamedly in that article spoke about the poor relations that Australia was having with Indigenous communities.
The reconciliation process does seem to have enabled a lot more official and authorised action by agencies in Australia to engage Aboriginal voices and Aboriginal conceptions and, more importantly, Aboriginal people in the processes and their communities, in the processes of things like ecological action.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he also raises the expectation that, you know, within the reconciliation process, I mean, who's speaking for who? And I think that's something that we're learning about reconciliation, that, you know, who's driving these understandings. And I think today we're understanding better ways to collaborate. We're understanding that there are the means for Indigenous-led projects, especially reconciliation, and within that we have ethics protocols, United Nations Declaration of Indigenous Rights. So it's quite a rich set of responsibilities there for designers to understand and act.
Is the landscape profession like architecture, an essentially conservative profession, or has it always been quite open to ideas like this? How did the profession react?
Wow, well, that's a big one. I mean, I think we always understood in our teachings here at UWA that there's a big gulf between the profession and the academy. The professions, especially landscape architecture, which I've been involved in, you know, at the Australian Institute of Landscape Architect level, is that it is very conservative. It's commercially cautionary. And I don't think it's really understood its own responsibilities with having relationships with the academy. So there is, you know, for example, the accreditation process of programs to call yourself landscape architect, there's the leakage of, you know, exemplary practice there, and exemplary teaching is disappointing. It's disappointing, but I think it's improving. Is the AILA have got now connection to country committees, and they're doing well to have cultural ambassadors in those Indigenous cultural ambassadors in those committees. But we've got a long way to go.
Is one of the problems about the conflict between the business models of landscape consulting and architectural consulting would be similar, that there are time frame differences between the calculations of investment and economic return, and then the calculations of ecological outcomes, or even the time span of the growth of plants, for example.
Yeah.
And so now we have this, being able to reconcile business models with these time frames creates immediate conflicts between the profession and landscape knowledge, ecological knowledge.
Yeah.
Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah, that is a fair thing. And it reminds me of Leon von Schaech's article in Curb. I think it was in the sixth or so edition, or where he talks about the slowness of landscape and the slowness of design. And he reminds people that we should always be wary and indeed responsible for the importance of slowness. Now that's a hard one to convince a developer and a commercial project
to invest
in slowness. You know, like one garden needs to evolve before another garden, you know, on a horticultural sense. You know, what's the succession of an environment in a development? They're big challenges. But Leon's article was influential, I think, to a lot of students at the time, that we should be wary of the speed in which we operate and the custodianship that's associated with speed. Yeah.
How do we change that, though? Because ultimately, as consultants, people are trying to bill out to feed their families, and they're working for people who are developing in order to get returns within 2 or 3 years or 7 years, again, to ultimately feed their families and communities.
Yeah.
How do we reconcile those massive differences in time frame of value?
Yeah. Well, that's a big question. And but you know, Ramesh, you've studied, you know, villages around the world, in particular, you know, villages in China and so forth, and in Asia. And I think there's always a really strong sense of community for those places that just evolve slowly, that are always understanding, you know, the heritage of their existence in a past, present, future sense. And they're always the rich places, I think, to visit and to live in. I mean, I think, you know, developers are hopefully reflecting and evaluating that a lot of these quick fix environments, they're not really producing a strong sense of place until they're taken over by the occupants, you know, and homeowners that then try to dismantle a lot of the structures in those communities to bring it back to home, you know, turning spaces into food production gardens, allowing people to meet where they shouldn't meet, changing colour codes and, you know, encumbrances on your titles, just so that we can start speaking to each other and, you know, and turning it into more an organic way of living. And I think developers are learning that slowly.
Have you seen the evidence of change or of progress as a result of this current strife of COVID, for example, and the sort of decline of traditional, or let's call them, capitalist economies?
Yeah. Wow. Well, I think there's a lot more respect there now. I think the fragility of COVID is woken up a lot of people to the relationships that we have with each other and with our own settings. I think some changes in that area. I live in a community in North Fremantle, and I'm really surprised about the discourse now that's coming through Zoom, online series, Facebook, you know, social media. Everybody in North Fremantle are kind of looking after each other a lot more than they did before. And they're creating, for example, the food production garden in North Fremantle, they're creating these environments where, you know, we can start caring for, you know, nutrition and sustenance in the community as well. Now, that's happened a lot, I think, from and during COVID. Yeah.
So I've read accounts of, and I don't have any direct experience of this, but accounts of economies such as Spain who have coped better in COVID, not so much from the point of view of participation in the global economy and its indicators, but of the wellness of citizens who still have resort back to their local communities and those food networks surrounding local communities. So do you think that the relationship with smaller communities is a part of that survival instinct that the COVID crisis somehow illuminates something about the way that we rely on these much larger structures?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there's always been this strong understanding of site specificity, and COVID's brought that home. I think we're able to change our lenses in knowing the differences between macro scale sites and small micro scale sites, and how we live between those scales. And that's kind of interesting. And most important for landscape architecture and architecture as environmental design. You know, how do we work within the scales? How do we bring the big into the small and vice versa? And how do we communicate it as we go? And I think COVID's opened up new ways of communicating.
You spent 5 years working in the School of Indigenous Studies at UWA. How has that informed your understanding or your ability to assess whether or not, as a society, we're making progress through ecological management and landscape?
Yeah. Well, I think I knew from an early age in academia that all roads were heading towards the School of Indigenous Studies. When I was first employed here at UWA Faculty of Landscape Architecture and Visual Arts, I was surprised that there was little collaboration across faculties in general, across schools. You know, academia is fraught with these kind of silos of knowledge, and we talk about it, but we don't really do it. And I was always interested in the design studio pedagogy of teaching landscape architecture, that we could cross the road and we could work with other schools. Now, my priority was to build up a relationship with the School of Indigenous Studies. I was interested in just listening to them and developing a relationship first. We didn't talk about co-teaching in the beginning. We were just talking about worldviews and our relationships to our own communities. People were writing about those relationships at the time, and it was just rich conversation for the students. to just move out of the design realm for a moment and just understand who they were as persons, how they were contributing to the well-being of Perth and Western Australia, especially when you had Aboriginal people in the room. And from those relationships, I was able to then develop some co-teaching programs with them. I brought that to the school here in design. We had exhibitions in the Cullity Gallery there on the ground floor. And for the first time, I think, we had Aboriginal communities come into this Faculty of Design. Now, that was kind of shocking for some. A lot of people in the administration and management were really nervous about that. And I, you know, that was perfectly understandable. But the students enjoyed it and they actually took charge in those invites and relationships. Now, from there, I went around the world a bit in my work and then worked with other Indigenous communities and then got the invite to become the Associate Dean of the School of Indigenous Studies. Now, for a white fella, that I knew that would be extremely difficult, but by then I was kind of honed in university administration. I had been in the Senate room at UWA a number of times. I understood how the big committees worked in this university, and I understood there was a conversation there about improving curriculum and improving pedagogies should Indigenous rights and the sharing of Indigenous knowledge really matter to the university. There was a lot of rhetoric there, but I think I was employed to get through the rhetoric and get some runs on the board. Now, eventually, my greatest goal was to get a design studio in the School of Indigenous Studies. And I was fortunate to do that. And that not only lent on the pedagogies of a design studio environment, but it also allowed multiple worldviews to be around the studio table. And we did some great projects. We ended up going across Australia and around the world. There were Indigenous students in those studios, and it was quite phenomenal. Now, to see those graduates now go off into other higher places and kick goals is it's kind of rewarding. And I think we've only just begun there, though, at that point. They will develop their own programs of change, and, you know, it's promising.
How far away are we, say, from seeing a landscape program, a program of learning landscape in which the Associate Dean of Landscape is an Indigenous person?
Well, you know, as I said in the article in the Curb Journal, we've got to be mindful of these university strategies at a national scale. You know, Universities Australia has had an Indigenous strategy for a long time. I think it's being renewed this year. Our own university here at UWA has an Indigenous employment strategy. How many academics in each of the schools around the campus know about that and how they're contributing to that employment strategy? I think very few know about their joint responsibilities there. And I think in every move that we make in each school around the university, we should be thinking about how do we employ Indigenous people and how can their voice be strengthened in each school and faculty. But I think, Ramesh, I think it's not far away. We now have Indigenous landscape architect graduates. We've got Indigenous architects in Perth. And I think the trick is to try to get them back to the academy. And I think that's one legacy in my work that I kind of failed, is that whilst they've gone out into the professions and practicing, it's important to get them back to the academy too, to allow them to be teachers and to attract, most importantly, other Indigenous students. And I think that's a big challenge, but that means that we've got to change curriculum. You know, predominantly Western design curriculum is taught in this school and in other schools. You know, okay, you might get the guest lectureship, the guest presenter from overseas who's Indigenous, but it's pretty superficial. I think we've got to put all the curriculum on the table and seriously review it from an Indigenous point of view.
At a personal level, Grant, to what extent do you feel like a representative of a paternalistic structure so that you become an agent for change, but you're a white fella?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why I asked the question is, you know, what's actually happening in Western Australia, which is so much more engaged with its Aboriginal population than some other states. I could be wrong about that, and we'll follow that up at some point soon.
Yeah.
But, you know, how much of it is a... do you feel that there are limits to what you can do in your advocacy and your agency that still requires some transfer of agency, maybe is the right word?
Well, that's a big one. And, you know, I always keep myself in check. I've fortunately got Indigenous friends that keep myself in check.
Yeah.
And we need that, especially, I would argue, in Western Australia, because it's now becoming the everyday. But the important thing here, and you're touching on it, is that, you know, what position are we taking in our behaviours in the collaboration with Indigenous peoples? You know, are we discoverers and are we being paternalistic, or are we going right through those set of behaviours to become change makers? And what I mean by that is that, and I think I'm here at that moment in my career where to be a change maker, it's not about yourself. It's not about your own authorship. It's about putting Indigenous, well, participating in allowing Indigenous people to take the forefront, for them to become the authors, for them to be in charge of their own knowledge, for them to get the awards from the Institute, you know, trophy nights. That is the real test for the profession and for the academy, is how do we follow standards and protocols to allow Indigenous people to be in charge of their own knowledges and the role that they want to play in these professions.
How much of a problem is the institutionalisation of these professions, let's say particularly landscape? The fact that it's almost like within the Western framework, being a landscape architect is almost like a cult of professional knowledge.
Yeah.
And so it's like a closed circle. Mm. And so to enter it, you need a certain level of training and authorization. And for an Indigenous person to enter that, it quickly becomes obvious that it's not only a set of technical or ecological or cultural skills, but it's also a social network generated system that is so dependent on hierarchies of agency and power. Is the institutional nature of professions and even universities an impediment to the entry of people? Because it's actually really hard to crack into university or to crack into the landscape profession or the architecture profession.
Yeah.
So do you think those institutional structures themselves are impediments?
Oh, very much. Very much. And I think, you know, we're coming back to the level of strife here. You know, the landscapes of those academies and professions are full of strife, are full of trauma and difficulty, are full of hardship. I mean, how often do, you know, academics argue with themselves about, you know, new changes in curriculum for community benefit? I mean, they're old arguments, they're old practices. But I think what you're saying, you know, these points are really exciting, because I always remember one of our studios, and you'll remember student Hazel Porter.
Yes.
Ryan, Hazel's gone on to great things, I think, over on the East.
Yeah.
But we did a design studio in Derby in the Kimberleys, and we had to design a set of living environments in Kamalunga, just out of Derby, an Aboriginal community. And it was funded by the Aboriginal Housing Department in Western Australia. Now, Hazel, in her site work, and we went to the community and stayed there for 2 weeks, she decided not to mention the word architecture once. She decided not to use any professional or academic jargon in the way that she spoke to and worked with the community. Now, that was quite phenomenal, because she opened up this amazing dialogue just about the importance of living for Derby residents, and what are the conditions of, you know, healthy conditions of living or desirable living in Derby. Now, we had a student prize. She won the prize, and her housing models were developed and constructed in Derby. And I think that was a good lesson for a lot of students, that they were able to critique the academy and the profession and say, wait a minute here, you know, who's driving who here? And you're right, are we over-institutionalizing these environments? And
I wonder whether it's a kind of cargo cult of access to building products, design products, and a whole sort of shipload of goodies that are delivered through through the professions and the developers and the government agencies. So the professions participate in that in very much the same way as a cargo cult.
Yeah.
So are we making progress, I guess, is still...
I think we're making progress when we broaden the invitation to the design table. If we've got a whole series of interesting people around the table and we're learning ways in to richly collaborate, and I'm not sure the design profession knows how to collaborate in a strict sense. I mean, that's some interesting scholastic work being done on collaboration at the moment around the world. But I think when we have the everyday, ordinary information at the table, as well as the high scholastic sort of intellectual rigour, perhaps, I think it becomes really rich. And for designers to be able to go out into the community and find those knowledge sets and give them the opportunity to represent those attitudes and beliefs, then the projects become quite rich.
I can still see a parallel between the resistance of developer groups, including designers and landscape architects, etc., in the requirements. They have skepticism of the requirements of Aboriginal community consultation.
Yeah.
There are legal frameworks around that. And I can see a parallel between that resistance, and the resistance of academic organisations and institutions in incorporating Indigenous knowledge.
Yeah. Good parallels.
Has that changed?
Yeah, well, I think there are projects where in the initial phases of developing a brief, for example, or just some game rules on relationships and behaviours, then a lot of that tension and strife needs to be dealt with, and a lot of it needs to be thrown in the bin. You know, you've got to break down this power and control around the table. And I think there are some good projects. I'm reminded of some of the work of Greg Rabash in the way that he's now employed as a facilitator in community projects. He's got into that position by a lot of hard work. A lot of runs on the board, but most importantly, a lot of relationship building with Indigenous communities. So he's now brought in to dismantle structures to begin with and say, right, we're all equal around the table. Perhaps we're not in some areas because you're the knowledge holder of that story. We're not, and so forth. So I think it's a lot more inclusive, a lot more equitable, and I believe it's just a richer design process. It's fairer. It's got a lot of empathy and honesty. And, you know, I think most importantly, we can wake up in the morning after a good night's sleep and feel pretty happy about it too, you know, which I think is really important, you know.
Yeah.
There's enough headaches in these professions and academies that are just quite ridiculous.
Again, coming back to the questions of strife, we've talked a little bit about the COVID crisis, but... perhaps the big strife is the climate emergency, and that creates strife for the entire Earth as well, and our world is continuing to be in trouble, in strife, in relation to climate change. What actions do you think are required by the landscape profession looking forward into this sort of uncertain century and more?
Wow. Well, you know, I always feel like the climate change debate is moves a lot faster than the understanding of relationships. And I think we can't expect to, for example, to bring Indigenous people to the table about climate change unless the project is the relationship. And I think we'll never, ever get a rich debate. We won't get agreeable solutions around climate change until we go way back and say, well, okay, how are we going to look after each other here in these relationships. And I think once we build that up, back to, for example, the work of Greg Grabash, once we build those relationships, then I think we can tackle some really big issues, e.g. climate change,
you know,
forest clearing, land management, et cetera, in landscape architecture.
The Local Code podcast has been brought to you by Solargain. Solargain has been in operation for over 20 years now. When you're looking for solar, go with someone who stands that test of time. Call today on 1300 739 355, or simply go to their website, solargain.com.au.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the emergence of voices such as Bruce Pascoe, who wrote Dark in You. I know that's condescending to say to you, but the profession perhaps shouldn't be debating anymore. Perhaps there's action already happening, taking place with people like Greg and with Bruce Pascoe. Indigenous voices are growing. Is the academy moving too slowly in the professional fields?
Yeah, I think so. I think, for example, we've always had the debate about design studios, and should there be studios where, you know, it's a bit like, you know, Architects Without Barriers or Frontiers and so forth. Should we have studios that are more action orientated? You know, what's the legacy of a studio? You know, are we really getting in there and helping to change environments and work with communities? Or are we just, you know, paralysing everybody through our own analysis? You know, I think we've got to take, admittedly, there are roles for some studios to explore just scholastic pursuits. That's very important. Students are not reading enough these days. They're not bringing forth a lot of, you know, intellectual rigor, I would argue. But also I think there's a role for studios to get out there and make a difference through design and construction, through, you know, land management practices, working with forestry agencies. I mean, where is landscape architecture in the field of regional and rural design? We barely touch it. But Pascoe and Gammage have given us the big picture to say, hey, we have responsibilities. And I think
so. Gammage is
the biggest estate on earth. I think once again, it's a discussion of scale, and the landscape architecture profession tends to come down to a scale that's kind of neat and tidy. You can wrap your arms around it, and you can, you know, assert your power and control.
Oversimplifying the responsibilities between a school training landscape architects over 4 years plus internship. The philosophy is often to deliver ready to go graduates for the profession's needs, which means business as usual needs. Does that model need to somehow have a bigger opening made for participation rather than just business as usual book learning, so that we can expose the landscape architects of the future to situations that are emerging, such as the community engagement of Greg Grabash, rather than learning it from a book that may have been published 5 years ago, let's say.
Very much. I mean, I was privy to working in some American offices where staff in those offices were professors. And I thought that was quite enlightening to experience that at an office level, that the office in many cases were invited into the academy and vice versa. So there was this really active dissolve between the two, and there was a place for reading and research, an R&D in a project. And there was a place to, you know, hit the technological books and make sure the design could, you know, stand up and work as a tectonic, perhaps. But I think that dissolve once again is really important, and I'm afraid now that the Academy is too concerned about occupational importance. You know, the work ready graduate.
Yeah.
I think there is a responsibility there, I think the Academy's got a job to inform the professions a lot more.
So do we have more answers available at our disposal that are coming through Indigenous knowledge than we are actually availing ourselves of, both in the Academy and in the profession?
Oh, very much, very much. Even in my little experience, the libraries of Indigenous knowledge available for the design professions is extraordinary and phenomenal, and we've barely scratched the surface.
So what are the best ways to gain access to those libraries? How do I get my library card?
Well, I think it's having Indigenous buddies, it's having relationships, and it's having, you know, colleagues in the Academy and the profession who are members of those Indigenous communities, and that the protocols and ethics of that engagement are followed. It's not rocket science. You know, there are ways and means of doing it, you know, productively, successfully. And of course, there's ways of failing and falling over in that experimentation. But we've got to have a go. And most importantly now, because the skills are out there, it should be Indigenous-led, those challenges. We know that we can get people at the table that will, you know, take us down the road together. And that's the great challenge. And it does open up a whole discussion once again about how do we collaborate? How do we dismantle some of the structures that we've been taught to protect ourselves, to hold the control of our own destinies? We've got to loosen up. We've got to experiment more. We've got to take more risks. But again, we're in good company if it's Indigenous-led, in my experience.
Yeah, there's a the climate change activism seems to open up a few possibilities for activism at the level of even small corners like our professions.
Mm.
But in a way, I wonder whether we're almost too timid with that.
Yeah.
And that we somehow need to get more in direct engagement with groups, particularly in Australia, with Aboriginal groups, to participate in our learning and work integrated learning practices.
Mm.
I don't know exactly how we do that, but you've spent 5 years working with the School of Indigenous Studies. Has that resulted in measurable, greater integration of what's going on in the training institution?
Well, I think there's been some success stories. I was only recently talking to a UWA academic from water research, and she's been doing some really interesting Indigenous collaborative projects about understanding water environments.
Who's that?
Her name escapes me.
It's not Carolyn Olden.
No. She's a Brazilian woman. I've only met her a couple of times, but I saw her at a workshop as well. She's working through the Jan Giupolini group that's coming out of UWA Business School, which is a really important achievement, I think, for UWA and the local Aboriginal communities of Perth, where now they have this group that is dealing with a lot of agencies and a lot of interested academics at various universities in Perth. I think Dan Giupolini and this water research is understanding it from an Indigenous point of view. I think the Indigenous participants for those projects are not only at the core, but they're also at the forefront of running those projects. And that's been a big difference. But it's a good question on why those academics have chosen to go that way. I mean, that's a very good question and a good inquiry. I think what motivates academics? I mean, I understand that there's a lot of hardship and strife in doing that, because often performance measures of academics they don't understand those challenges. You don't get points for dismantling your own practices because you want to be inclusive, you know. Doesn't work like that, but unfortunately it should.
But there are measures now, increasing measures of impactness or impactfulness in academic performance. And so relevance in research and impact are more and more important indicators rather than peer assessment, let's say.
Yeah.
So I suppose the institution of academia itself is under challenge.
Yes.
And appears to be responding in certain ways, whether it's enough or not, who knows. But I'm believing that there still is a place for university-led training of professionals like landscape architects. It would be interesting to see how best we leverage that, those cross-disciplinary relationships, especially with Indigenous knowledge.
Because it
seems like the School of Indigenous Studies has been quite a small outpost for a long time now, and it's I was just curious, we'll probably talk to them quite soon to see how they feel their impact is starting to operate, because it is a long haul.
Yeah. Well, one thing I did learn by being Associate Dean at that school is the extraordinary pressure that that school is under. You know, to be fair, and the school can, you know, in its leadership can speak for itself, but the amount of business that comes through that front door and the stress and strife associated with that is quite extraordinary. And, you know, the lifespan of a lot of the staff members in that school are really limited, can I say, because, you know, we all know that the burnout factor in Indigenous schools and in this area of Indigenous studies, it's quite acute.
Yeah.
It's quite acute. And, you know, I think the School of Indigenous Studies has picked its battles really carefully. And they work at a very high national level, you know, in their leadership.
Sure.
And they're on some serious national education committees that are working at, you know, employment strategies across university sectors, curriculum change measures and funding, and most importantly, Indigenous scholarships. So Indigenous students can come to universities. So some big challenges there. But I think that school has been very successful in the amount of Indigenous students that are at UWA.
Yeah.
And admittedly, they've been populated in medicine faculties and schools, law and social work and nursing. I mean, they're priority areas. But I think over time, it will be exciting to see students in the other schools. And I think we've got a responsibility in those schools is to make the school is attractive to Indigenous students.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how many Indigenous artists, for example, are at this fine arts program in this faculty? You know, I mean, those numbers are greater, of course, in Curtin University, where the program is more attractive to Indigenous art students. But this program here needs to be informed by those Indigenous art students, more so than I would say the Indigenous scholars, Western scholars that are in the fine arts program here at this faculty. It's a bit lopsided. You know, when you have the expertise at the staff level and you don't have the student body, I think there's some question marks there.
Yeah. Now, there's been great progress made in the arts, definitely. I've just seen that through projects in the city, through government development agencies, who have got principles of engagement that are organised around Aboriginal seasons and project management principles and consultation principles.
Yeah,
I haven't seen similar action at the the level of the academic disciplines themselves, you know, which is surprising because we're supposed to be the ones on the edge and the agencies are supposed to be following, but it seems to be the opposite way.
Yeah. Well, I think that's some really good points there, and I don't think, you know, there's a lot of information out there at the moment in the Indigenous space. There's some extraordinary writers and scholars that are holding strong Indigenous voices. And I don't think our students are aware of that library. What I mean by that is that they've got to do the hard work and they need academic leaders to direct them into those corridors of, you know, and those libraries of knowledge.
Yeah.
A lot of it, again, is by oral history. A lot of it, some, you know, bringing Indigenous people into the classroom and having that knowledge firsthand and firsthand experiences, which is really important. But I think also, you know, our libraries have got to expand with those other volumes. So they sit proudly on the shelf and students don't have an option not to pick them up and get into them. But that'll change, I think, when we do have more Indigenous professors in the schools.
Yeah.
You know, they'll rely on those texts.
Yeah, right, sure. Now, Brad, just to wind up, what's next for you in your progress? I read on the, I Googled you, I discovered that you are now classified as retired.
Yes. Yeah. Fortunately, I'm in this space now for retirement. I mean, retirement's an awkward word, but it is a transformation. I'm giving back to the academy. I'm looking after graduates that are now teachers and graduates that are running successful practices. So I feel like I owe a mentorship role to those graduates because it's, you know, it's a jungle out there. And I think if we can give any support to our graduates, then all well and good. And I mean that sincerely because I think the academy should take that responsibility. It's all very well to go to a graduation ceremony, but to look after these professionals as they go out into the wild worlds is really important. And now, admittedly, the profession has a role there, but I think their teachers and never stop teaching them. And I take that responsibility, you know, sincerely and deeply. My heart health relies on that in some ways. So it's giving back. It's being on various committees and boards now to give back and to provide some sort of guidance.
And engagement with communities.
Yeah.
Is that
I'm working with Greg Grabash. That's exciting. And I'm interesting enough, I'm going back home. To work with Greg. He's now in Adelaide. That's where, you know, I grew up in those Adelaide Hills. And I've been helping to join some dots in my life. My mother and father have recently passed over. So it's a wake-up call for me to go back home and understand that a lot more. Greg's practicing there and I'm now helping with bringing the Indigenous voice to the table for Greg in certain areas of Adelaide. And that's really exciting.
Yeah.
We're looking at some weird and wonderful projects. I've been involved in a fishery in the Coorong, an Indigenous fishery. We've been looking at the protection of wetlands around Port Adelaide a management of an island down the south off of Victor Harbour. So, but it's giving back mainly. I'm trying to still write. And I've formed this new group called the Listening Foundation. And I'm just trying to hone my skills in listening a lot more when I come to the table with my Indigenous partners. Working a lot more with some Whadjuk Noongar elders in the Swan Coastal Plain. That's exciting too.
Oh, it sounds very exciting. Look forward to hearing more about it in the future.
Giving back more to family too. I feel like as the academics, we forget about family sometimes. You know, our family become our students. And I mean that sincerely again. And you know, we've got to go home and, you know, look after the kids too. And my kids, like your kids, you know, we've shared, you know, the UWA growth of our kids is quite extraordinary. You know, that's an interesting topic.
Yeah.
You know, one day they're going to talk about the UWA influence on their childhoods, and I think that's really important.
Yeah.
But my kids now are almost like ones in the early 30s, late 20s, and they grew up with their dad banging his head at UWA for many years, and I feel like I owe them some sort of reconciliation. about what that meant and, you know, who benefited from that, especially the students.
Yeah, look forward to talking again, Grant Revelle. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ramesh.
A huge shout out to Grant Revelle for coming in to record that. That was an amazing insight into what you would probably say is a big transition slowly getting towards a reconciliation between landscape architecture and Indigenous culture and the stories that the two bring together. It was really good to listen to Grant's background in terms of his teaching philosophy and how he went about teaching and how he tried to, in a way, be a mentor for the future of landscape architecture. So we were very privileged to listen to that, and I thought it was a great listen. Speak to you soon, guys. Renee out. Bye. The Local Code podcast has been brought to you by Solargain. Solargain has been in operation for over 20 years now. When you're looking for solar, go with someone who stands that test of time. Call today on 1300 739355 or simply go to their website, solargain.com.au.